Welcome. I'm Harmony Slater, your host of the Finding Harmony podcast. Over the past 20 years, I've taught thousands of yoga teachers and students to explore the intersection between ancient wisdom and modern everyday life using mind-body practices to heal, awaken, and manifest their dreams from the inside out. This podcast is a sanctuary for those feeling overwhelmed by life's challenges. Are you ready to jump in and discover how these challenges aren't actually in the way, but are the way to finding harmony? Let's invite the magic back in. Hi, and welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. This is part one of a two-part episode where we are diving deep with our good friend, Tom Norrington Davies, who is a cook, a chef, and a writer. He's also an authorized Ashtanga yoga teacher, of course. So we are talking about how cooking and yoga are related and his personal journey from his true love, which is food and being a chef, into probably another true love, which is practicing and teaching yoga. And if you know anything about Russell and I, you know that we love cooking shows and we love chefing. And so this is really a conversation that was most enjoyable for us to have. I cannot wait to introduce you to Tom Norrington Davies and all of his beautiful, hilarious stories around what brought him into yoga and his experience being a chef, opening his own restaurant, selling his own restaurant, and all the things in between. We're going to jump in right now with Tom Norrington Davies. Hi, and welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. I'm your host, Harmony, and I'm here with Russell Kay.
Good morning, Harmony.
And we're joined by Tom Norrington Davies. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I don't know. Do I say good morning or good evening?
Good evening.
Good evening for you.
It's good evening for you.
Are you in London?
Yes.
Is that where you are? South London.
South London. Peckham.
Peckham.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I know that train stop. I used to live in Brighton, down in the south.
Even further south.
Even further south.
Even further south than South London. Yeah.
That's true. And I'm trying to remember, and I think it's entirely plausible that I would have finished teaching, would have finished my practice, I would have gone home, as was my wont. I would have had my little bowl of granola, and I'd watch Animal Planet, which is broadcast, you know, from the BBC at Bath. And I'm trying to remember, like, I really would have watched a cooking show with Tom Norrington Davies. Like, that would have been a thing I would have done in 2005.
No.
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely a thing I would have done. I would have sat there with, even in the morning with my cereal, or in the evening with my biscuit and rooibos.
This is a terrible thing to admit to, but so at that point, I was mainly known as a food writer. And that show, I actually had just worked for them as a researcher, and it was going to be presented by a historian stroke architect, and it was going to have a kind of regional history bent to it. And then he had to pull out. He got involved in some great, huge project that just meant he was committed elsewhere. And the production team turned around to me and said, well, look, you wrote so much of this. You know, do you want to present it? And I thought, jeepers. Because the real answer was no, not massively. I'm kind of weirdly shy for a show-offy chef. I'm quite happy showing off in writing. But the idea of on camera, I just thought, I'm going to be like a rabbit in headlights. This is going to be awful. And then when they said it's Discovery Channel, I just thought, okay, I'm going to do it because
no one is ever going to see this show.
And it's weird. To this day, I'll get someone will be like, I'm sitting in a hotel in Singapore and you're on the telly. So it pops up to haunt me. I made six episodes.
Oh, wow.
I was weirdly never asked back to do a second season. So I think I got rumbled that I wasn't, you know, in my element.
Oh, no.
But it was fun. It was fun to do. I got...
What?
God, what it would be a lifelong dream.
Yeah, what were you explaining? What was the show like?
So they jigged it, rejigged it so that I would do some actual cooking rather than just go. So it was going around the country and meeting people that were doing really unusual things in the British Isles. So there, for instance, there was a tea plantation in Cornwall, a guy making ice cream out of sheep's milk in Somerset, a couple making rose water in Cambridgeshire, just things that even though they were, so it was, the irony was that it was about British food, but a couple growing every kind of chili imaginable in Dorset, who had invented a chili that was the hottest chili on the Scoville scale. You know, it was insanely hot. You wouldn't ever want to eat this thing called the Dorset Naga. So although these were British ingredients, the idea was it wasn't sort of pie and mash and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it wasn't traditionally British.
Yeah, it was just to show the diversity. Later on, a much more famous guy, Rick Stein, who's a famous chef here, he made a TV show called Rick Stein's Food Heroes, which was along similar lines. So I would go around meeting all these people, and then I'd take the ingredients back to my flat, which wasn't my flat at all. It was some stooge kitchen in somewhere much nicer than Peckham. And I'd cook. And then I'd get people round, taste these dishes and things. And sometimes they'd get the suppliers to come. The guys that were the producers would also come and try the food that I'd made from that thing and then be really polite about it. And hopefully not
that's
bar
so
from,
cool.
Yeah.
You were like a pioneer in the cooking show television world.
I would say definitely not a pioneer. I think sort of an unwilling
participant.
Yeah, a reluctant.
A reluctant chef.
A reluctant, yeah. Dragged kicking and screaming onto the telly for one season only. So, yeah, maybe it'll be like Fawlty Towers, you know. I think they only made 12 episodes of Fawlty Towers. So maybe one day.
Is it only 12?
12 episodes. Yeah, he did two series and then he was exhausted. God. Understandably, from just being so manic.
That's the thing with British television, isn't it? It's also like The Office. Ricky Gervais made like 12 episodes.
Yes.
And then the first run in the States of The Office, they're going to make 24 because that's what you do in a season.
You go bigger.
And just like the amount of unpaid help available in the United States to work in the film industry is gigantic. And so they'll get like 30 people in a writing room and 28 of them are interns, and then they'll generate 24 episodes. And it's insane. But like you hear about like Ricky Gervais after The Office was just absolutely, what did you say? Knackered.
Knackered. Yeah. Oh, yes. Knackered. Yeah. Exhausted.
Exhausted. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
God.
I think less is more, isn't it?
Yeah.
In Britain. Less is more.
Less is more. Yeah.
In the United States, more is more.
More is more in the state.
Like your portion sizes, food portions.
Yeah.
Portion sizes in the States, more is more.
Yeah, it's massive.
Oh, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. Last night, we were so excited. We were in bed. We were watching Hot Ones with Gordon Ramsay, trying to prepare for the show.
Wonder what Hot Ones is. That must be called something else here. What does he do in Hot Ones?
It's a YouTube show.
In Hot Ones, they have
a
YouTube show, and they have a set of 10 chicken wings. And they go from the lowest on the Scoville scale.
Well, it's not the absolute lowest. They start at the highest. Like 1600, right?
You know, like in the commercial grade, sweetie. And so they'll start at like 1600 and they'll go to like 2 million sometimes. And we were watching it and it was like Gordon Ramsay lost his fucking mind. Trying to eat them. He had a meltdown.
It was so fun.
And Harvey and I had been to the Hot Sauce Museum in New Orleans.
I've been there.
And they had given us, Have you?
Did you try the hottest hot sauce on the planet with the little toothpick drop?
Yes, I think I did. And that was like...
The ice cream. 15 million.
Yeah.
It was insane. And do you remember what they did? They gave you an antidote. Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember. Maybe they didn't give
you didn't need an antidote. Yeah. Jesus Christ. They gave us horseradish.
Oh, wow.
And you ate the horseradish and it just completely obliterated the taste and the pain.
The pain, the burning.
Millions of little needles in your tongue.
That's interesting because horseradish hits you elsewhere. Like chili is also always on the tongue, yeah. Right? But horseradish goes up. I mean, kind of who needs
your nose?
Yeah, you don't need a netty thing. Just
horseradish.
Well, that's what they said. They said horseradish is like a different type of spice, so it has like a different composition that counterbalances the spicy spice of the chili,
yes.
I guess.
It's like a wasabi. Wasabi is a radish. Yeah. Horseradish, yeah. Isn't it? I grow horseradish. I have a horseradish in my fridge. It is the ugliest. Really? Have you ever seen it fresh?
No.
No. You have
Do you
to get
see
it out
a fresh one.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Bring it out.
It is ugly, ugly. Hang on.
Let's see. Oh.
Oh.
It looks like someone left a parsnip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Took a parsnip and left it in the back of their fridge for 100 years. But whoa. It's
Does wow. it smell intense?
Oh, yeah. Scratch and sniff.
Wow. It's like a cross between ginger, garlic, turmeric, a parsnip.
And a carrot.
And a marital maybe. Aid.
Yeah.
And a marital aid is what I was
and
thinking.
And a marital aid.
I knew that's what you were thinking, Russell. That's why I said it.
With a condom, it would be all right, honestly. I think it would be... fine.
That's funny.
Yes. I'll tell you a quick aside. This is very much an aside, but I got taken. So when you write about cookery, after a certain, and I didn't do this on purpose, I got this letter just arrived. And apparently I had mentioned Tabasco sauce like X amount of times. There's a point, there's a sort of number that you reach when you get this letter from the McElhennies who make the you know, and it says, you're now an honorary member of the Tabasco Club. And by the way, would you like to come to Avery Island as a guest of the McElhennies and see how it's made and go to the museum and yada, 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 yada. And they flew
wow.
me. They flew me to...
No.
Yeah. They flew me to Houston, Texas. And then they drove me and a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
The latest, the new members of the club. For our strange
clubs.
Showed us around. Did you go around seeing it made in the big barns where they?
No, we had just gone to a little.
Oh, the museum's in town, isn't it? It's in New Orleans.
Yeah.
In New Orleans, and it's you know the size of a
small shop.
Small
it's really
flat.
Wee. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But so we went to Avery Island, which is this crazy salt plug in the middle of the bayous, and that was the weird thing. The guy McElhenney, the original, the founder. He was a perfumier, and this island has two things. It's like it's an island like in a swamp, so it's not surrounded by ocean, but bayous and stuff. It had a salt plug and these strange peppers, which are native to Mexico, but grow quite happily in that region. And so at the Civil War, he couldn't export his perfume. So he started fermenting these chilies with the local salt in old bourbon barrels. And then potting up the resulting gunk in his little perfume bottles. And that's why Tabasco comes in these teeny tiny little...
Right. Yeah, little perfume bottles.
Yeah, dab, dab.
Dab, dab.
But hotter than fantastic. That chili in the museum was going around these huge barns. And like floor to ceiling of bourbon. Barrels, because you can only make bourbon in a barrel once, because the barrel is singed, you know, to give it that caramelizing.
Right. Color.
And then they can use it for Tabasco after that. So it's recycling these old barrels. Every now and again, one of these barrels would just go like blip as the chilies in the barrel were fermenting. And it's like a little volcanic boop off the top of the barrel. And after a few minutes, we're all still standing there going... And the guy's like, oh, yeah, by the way, it gets in the air and then we're like,
it becomes pepper spray. Yeah.
It was like being sort of, imagine pepper mist if you're sort of more gentle than.
Pepper mystic.
Pepper mist. Yeah.
I'm not going to pepper spray. I'm going to mist. Pepper mist. I'm
going to mist you.
It was one of the most bizarre experiences. And then they took us into New Orleans. It was all singing, all dancing. Tabasco Museum, and then out for dinner.
Amazing.
It was amazing,
That's
actually.
So fun. That's so fun.
When I asked the agent who'd arranged this, I said, you know, this must be insanely expensive for them. And they went, yeah, but just think of the ads that you writers, I mean, you mentioned it this amount of times. Yeah. You're going to mention it forever now, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Totally. Yeah.
You're like an ambassador.
Bathe in
wow, stuff. You are. You're an ambassador for yeah. Tabasco.
I guess probably in the age of the influencer, they probably don't do it anymore. This is before there was anything
yeah.
like it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Like the original influencer.
We do a running gag on the show where I come up with a fake ad that we've been promoted by, like Dos Equis beer things. We'll be doing Tabasco for
oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
The Nicolini family has made Tabasco sauce on Avery Island, Louisiana, for over 5 generations. Built on a salt dome, it's a mysteriously beautiful place where the red peppers grow, the factory hums, and abundant wildlife can be seen in jungle gardens.
Didn't see much wildlife.
False advertising.
I swam in a bayou.
That's not safe.
Yeah,
I know.
God.
Okay, dangerous. Do you want another quick?
No.
This is another quick yes. aside because I'm sure we got more serious yes. things to talk about. So they take us out on one of those boats and it was amazing. And then the guy said, so look, now you're in the Tabasco Club. You've got to jump in the bayou. You've got to swim round the boat. They stopped and they said, who's going to jump in the bayou, swim around the boat? And they said, just to let you know, if you don't do it, you'll be the first person to ever say, to ever, you know, like Welsh on the, you're not going to do it. And so me and this other Brit journalist guy called Dan just stripped off and jumped in the bayou, at which point everybody started screaming. And they said, you're the first guys to ever fall for that prank. No one else ever jumped in the only...
yeah, you...
Dan was stupid enough to fall for it. So they dragged us out before the alligators got us.
Yeah, because you could be eaten by alligators.
Yeah, that's so funny.
We would go and swim after school. We'd get out, we'd drive over to the creek, as we call it, which I think is what you would refer to as a creek.
Yeah, it's a creek.
We'd go to the creek and we'd strip off and we'd you know, get on our inner tubes and jump in the water. And I do remember, have you ever heard of a nutria?
No.
A nutria is something in Louisiana that they're trying to promote as a new food source. I think ostensibly to try and solve the problem of overpopulation of nutria. Nutria is the largest form of rat in the rat family.
Ew.
You've heard of it. You have heard of it.
They eat something similar in South America, don't they? Or is that a guinea pig?
Oh.
Like a guinea pig.
It's like, but that's, we can look that up as well.
Yeah.
But I'm just like swimming and I just remember like a small,
like a muskrat?
It's like a muskrat, but much bigger. And it was like a toddler had decided to take a swim. And I was like, oh, there's a toddler over there.
Oh.
And he just like little giant head as big as mine, as big as my head, just paddled by, took a look at me. It was like, oh, hello. And then
kept
paddling by. And he was every bit of 4 feet.
Ooh, scary. A massive rat.
Kind of like a big otter or seal or something.
Yeah, I guess you could normalize it. If you wanted to.
Not like little Ratty from Wind in the Willows. Just
But that's just a thing. Yeah, we should be eating more nutria. That's what I'm saying. But let's start at the beginning. You must smoke. You smoke cigarettes?
I did. I haven't for a long time.
Why do the fucking chefs all smoke? Why do you start out sous chefs in washing dishes, cooking up appetizers, and then like, oh, I'll go have a fag?
We always think it must spoil the palate.
You hit the nail on the head in that I'll go have a fag because it's a chance for a break.
Yeah.
In a world where can I go and have a cup of tea, everyone would be like, what?
Then, no.
But if you just announce, I've got to go and have a cigarette, then no one bats an eyelid. Yeah, it's probably the only officially recognized break in a commercial kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's true.
Yeah, pretty much every cook I knew smoked when I was doing catering.
But wouldn't it just destroy your palate?
I guess it probably does a bit. Although, considering the amount of chefs that do or have done.
I know.
I think.
You wonder, right?
Oh, a lot of people say that it's the reason, one of the reasons chefs tend to season food heavily is because that's a smoker's palate. you know.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Oh.
And it'd be interesting survey to do whether food has got less sort of intensely seasoned, or definitely less salty since chefs all started giving up smoking left, right, and center. I mean, I gave up decades ago. I gave up. We had a ban on smoking in restaurants come in 2007, and that actually was the year we opened our restaurant. We knew the ban was coming, so we decided to open as a non-smoking restaurant, and I thought I'd better be, you know, walk the walk, talk the talk kind of thing. So I decided to stop straight away. I had also just started practicing, and I do remember one time very soon after doing this, you know, I'm sat outside the restaurant. I just did this beautiful breathing thing for like 2 hours. What? How is this? This has got to go, you know.
Right.
Yeah, that was one thing for me because I was smoking when I first started practicing yoga.
Because you're a ballerina and they all smoke.
Yeah, I was an ex-ballerina.
Yes,
but I still
probably
kept
the only other profession that could probably outdo chefs is ballet.
It's true, right?
Yeah. And models.
But yeah, that was a big thing. Like the yoga practice, I think, really shifted that for me. Is I don't know, you just get so much awareness of what you're doing to your body and the feeling of it and the taste. Like you really, I don't know, your consciousness really like increases. And then you're like, oh, what am I doing? Why would I spend all this time trying to detox and cleanse and breathe deeply and then just like throw toxins into my body again?
yeah. No, it did seem a bit daft. So I thought, come on, it's over. Yeah. Game's up. I'd given up a few times before. I tried a number of times. And I was a very casual smoker. I wasn't a committed 20 a day kind of dude. I could never smoke in the morning. Weirdly, I always found that revolting. I could never really smoke until towards the end of a shift. So well into the evening.
Right.
Who knows?
Then it's like a stress relief.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Also, it's a stimulant, right? So maybe in the morning you just didn't feel like you needed that kind of stimulation to your nervous system. Whereas at night you're kind of dragging. You're like, oh, I could really use a little hit right now.
Yeah. So awful, isn't it? I never look back. So the minute I decided to quit, that was it. I've never had a waking craving. I've dreamt that I've smoked, but I've never craved it awake.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Interesting. I want to go back there to where you were when you started smoking rather than when you finished.
Smoking.
And we'll build up to when you finished smoking.
Started behind the bike sheds in school, you know, classic 16-year-old.
Totally.
When I was in high school, I had read On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
Mm-hmm.
I'd become completely enamored with the beat movement of poetry and living and kind of. And it was in the books were kind of side by side with my kind of dog-eared copy of the Tao Te Ching. It was like, oh, this is a way to live. This is kind of Taoist flow. I'm going to go work in a restaurant washing dishes and nothing could have been more kind of real and substantive and anti-bourgeois and anti-suburban as that. And that's, of course, that was my life, you know, a little suburban white boy. So going into the kitchen in New Orleans and working, scrubbing dishes was just awesome to me. Like this was real life. My fingers were actually bleeding. I was doing real work for money and food, which I preferred the food at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something that happened that really became a real fork in the road for me and sometimes I deeply regret is that I started to get into fights with a chef because she wanted me to cook. She wanted me to step up from washing dishes to doing apps and really helping out. And I get so fucking pissed. I was like, no, I'm washing dishes. You want the fucking dishes done? I'm washing the fucking dishes. I don't want to do apps. I don't want to become a fucking chef. I'm here to fucking work with my hands, asshole. You know? And now, of course, you know, I guess 30 years later, God, I'd love to be a fucking chef. I'd love to have been groomed as a chef in New Orleans and be a fucking French New Orleans chef. Mm-hmm. That'd be fucking amazing. And I was like, that was it. That was my entree.
And you 15
years old, 16 years, and I missed it.
You could be knocking out Oysters Rockefeller.
Oh, yeah. Fucking shucking fucking oysters, mate. I'd be fucking happy as a clam. But you didn't. You were supposed to be a thespian.
Yep.
And you're probably working with the, you know, Royal Shakespeare Company or something like that. But
No, it's just a university.
You went in the opposite direction.
So I wasn't a fully formed thespian. I was on the way. And yeah, you touched on it actually. One of the reasons I had ulterior motives for getting sort of holiday and weekend jobs in restaurants or hotels or basically wherever there was a job. And part of that was getting fed. You know, because, yes. Yeah, you're a student, you've got no money, you know. And I could never make my grant go quite far enough. I'm old enough to remember when the UK government would actually give you money to go to university rather than charge you through the nose for it like they do.
Right.
Now, and keep you in debt for the rest of your life.
It's the American way.
It's the American dream.
Yes. Yeah. Which is why people like me could go and do completely pointless degrees like drama.
Exactly.
Which led to a long and fruitful career in hospitality, you know. And I should say that it wasn't like these environments were unfamiliar to me because I'd come from a family. My paternal grandmother was a minister's wife. My grandfather was a Methodist minister. And they were actually down here in South London. They ran this very urban chapel and attached to it was what came to be known locally as Clubland, which sounds funny because that you think of sort of Soho nightclubs, but this was all sort of societies for boys and girls, you know, like getting kids off the street and into social kind of club.
Right.
It was this sort of a precursor to what now is described as the sort of youth club movement. And this Clubland, Walworth Methodist Church and Hostel was its real name, had a huge refectory. And community and cooking was just my grandmother's thing. And I grew up sort of, I just remember sort of getting under her feet. And some of my biggest childhood memories are being in my grandmother's kitchen and never being kind of scooted out of the way. There was something about it that must have stuck with me. And then, so yeah, whenever I had a holiday job, just being in a kitchen just felt good. And the older I got, the more fascinated I became by it all. And the switch point was, funnily enough, just before I went to college, I had the summer between leaving school and going to uni. I went and worked down in Cornwall in a hotel on breakfasts. I volunteered to do the breakfast shift because it could get you out onto the beach faster. You know, I was done by, I had to be there by 7 in the morning, but I was out by 2 in the afternoon, a bit like teaching Ashtanga yoga.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you're done by lunchtime. And
your afternoons are free.
That appealed greatly. And I remember telling myself, I'm going to learn to surf. I'm in Cornwall, and I never did learn to surf, but I'm really fucking good at scones. Really, I make great cream tea. And so that was the beginning of it. Off I go to college. And as far as I'm concerned, all the way through college, it is just about getting some extra money, you know, making ends meet.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter from kind of, I was in Seafront University up in Mid Wales, Aberystwyth. And it didn't matter whether it was crumbling Seafront Hotel. I worked in a chippy on the pier. I just, anyway.
Fish and chips, sweetie.
Fish and chips, absolutely. I just was kind of, I just found the buzz. Something about it got to me. And also, in the meantime, I had become a keen, and I didn't equate these two things at that point, but I was an extremely keen cook. And this is funny because this is kind of not unrelated to where we're going, but this is the 1980s. And my parents, halfway through this decade, discover a cookery phenomenon on UK TV, Maja Jaffrey. She's the first sort of Indian TV chef in the UK. The BBC make this show, An Introduction to Indian Cookery, and she writes a cookbook of the same name, which changed my folks' life. They were obsessed with her.
Oh.
We stopped having Sunday roasts and started having Indian food. And
you'd have a cousin on Sunday.
Well, they call it a curry lunch.
Yeah. I mean, curry lunch.
Very inaccurate. Posh. Yes. Yeah, they were quite posh. And they'd get loads of people around. And so my dad would spend like hours in the kitchen on a Saturday getting these, you know, and I'd help. And then, yeah, and I was so
that's amazing.
Into this. Yeah, I loved it. It was one of my favorite memories of my teenage years. And then, so when I go off to uni, my mum says to me, look, this is for you. It was also my 18th birthday present. It was the book. And then she, do you remember cassettes? Remember when, you know, cassette boxes? There's audio. Cassette boxes. You can put all your cassettes. She had bought a cassette box, stenciled chilies and stuff all over it. And in this cassette box, instead of cassettes, was every single spice in the book.
Oh, wow.
Every spice I might need to cook from this
book. It was full of spices, not audio cassette.
No cassettes.
About spices.
No, not
okay, 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 okay.
She'd upcycled it before upcycling was even a thing. She'd pimped it.
She had.
Yeah, that's so cool.
The cassette box.
The cassette box. It was amazing. I mean, and this thing saw me through college. And obviously I lighted straight away on the cheapest two things in there, which was there's some dish with saag, which you could make with frozen spinach, and dal. Yeah. And I'd just make vats of dal. And then I'd say, everyone come around, all back to mine for dal.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Because that's what I thought you did. You cooked this food for as many people as you could cram into your little student accommodation and all sit on the floor eating dal. Many, many years before I ever set foot on the subcontinent, I was really into
That's a true samskara at that point.
The future informing the past.
It's the future informing the past for sure.
Yeah. But I think, for me, cooking is so much about that. Even though it went on to become something I did for a living, at the heart of it was always this just cooking for people is such a lovely thing. You know, you.
Yeah. Like love and connection.
Yeah, it is. It's a really nurturing thing. I would say it allows humans to be generous with each other in a way that transcends wealth. You know, you must have had that where you meet the poorest people on the planet and they want to
in
feed
India,
you.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Especially in India. It's like it's so incredible. They really want you to come over and have a meal with them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have to. I mean, it's so, it's such a...
You do have to.
Yeah, it's such an honor, but also, beautiful part of their culture.
Mm.
Oh.
So tell us how you got into his... Yeah.
Not yet.
Oh, not yet?
Wait. Yeah, he's got to get into his restaurant first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then he has to tell us about the restaurant.
So that's kind of a long story. And to cut it short, I graduate and I have a year or so just traveling. Because I wasn't really sure that I wanted to sort of knuckle down just yet. So I did what, at that point, everyone seemed to be, if you talk about a gap year.
A gap year.
I go around Southeast Asia. And I spent some time working in Hong Kong, because back in those days, that was really easy if you're from the UK.
Right.
Ostensibly to go and teach English as a foreign language, but I didn't end up doing that. Because someone heard my posh accent. And so I did manage to do some stage management work. I found this gig. It was like a Broadway, numbers from Broadway being performed in all these clubs and hotels and things all around Hong Kong by this slightly jaded group of Americans. And one of them said to me after I was operating the spotlight for them because it was a drama graduate. So that was great. You know, it's like this... proper job.
You're in the industry.
I'm in the biz, yeah. And one of them said to me, God, you've got a really fucking posh English accent, haven't you? Are you from there? And I said, yeah, I'm from London. You know. He said, look, my boss, when we're not doing the show, some of us dub Kung Fu films into English from Cantonese.
Amazing.
And they're always looking for Brits to play the sinister bad person, you know, the bad guy.
Of course.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I go along and I audition with my posh English voice. I meet this hilarious character called Rick Thomas, who's being a dubber's agent and also directs the dubbing operation.
The dubber handler.
Dubber handler. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And he says to me, you're not an actor, are you? And I was like, no, why? And he went, good, because dubbing is not acting. Dubbing is its own art form. And so I was like, okay. And then went on to be, well, I mean, the guy was such a huge lovey. It was fantastic. And we were dubbing so many films. And every time, yeah, I just had to be the sort of beard-stroking baddie, you know. I did it for about a year before. Then went off and did what I'd originally planned to do, which was, you know, hang out in Bali and Thailand and yada, yada, yada. And
why
then went
you
back
ever
to London.
Stop?
So I go back to London kind of skint, but, well, having been paid quite handsomely to do these movies.
Yeah.
Not a single one of which, you know, when you're young and you don't, you just sort of think, ha, ha, ha. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And did I save a single VHS of one of these things? No.
No.
And luckily, no one's ever phoned me up from a hotel in Singapore going, I think you're in the film I'm watching. Someone sounds a lot like you, but they're not a very nice person. In fact, they just killed a whole room full of people, you know, with one stroke of their beard.
Yeah.
So I come back to London and, I mean, the logical thing to do is to start mooching around in restaurants again. I start in a little vegetarian cafe in Greek Street in Soho. And then I sort of job about for a bit. And then I meet this life-changing Italian chef, Carla Tomasi.
Can you tell us about what that was like for you?
And the first thing was, I remember the Christmas after I just started working in this place, I went home and my mum sort of says to me, you know, so where are you working now? In a slightly, you know, to me, she sounds a little weary. I'm detecting weariness. It's like,
yeah.
And I said, oh, this is an amazing restaurant called The Peasant. It's fantastic. It's all seasonal Italian, very rustic, cucina povera kind of thing. But I am still looking for a proper job. And she's like, oh, really? I've started telling all my friends you're a chef. And I said, you're not annoyed by that? You know, you don't mind? You don't think I just wasted 3 years? She was like, no, it's fantastic. I think it's amazing. I think you should do, you know, you should follow your heart. You're a chef. Why have I noticed first?
That's so like, cool.
Okay, she's not angry with me. I don't know why I thought she would be. I thought my folks might be a bit disappointed that I'd sort of turned my back on my glorious academic career to, you know, dub Hong Kong movies and then cook.
Your glorious career as a dub voice actor.
Well, it's not too different, is it? Because it's, in any of the arts, whether you're a painter or a chef, you're a manual laborer.
Yes,
and
very much.
You're
so,
still a worker. And so you're not going into finance, you're in the arts. And so one isn't actually different from the other.
It's true. You're a bunch of ne'er-do-wells. Yeah.
You're a punk.
It is a bit punk. And actually, my first few years in restaurants, I did notice, I mean, you're with the baddest kids from school, the kids who fell foul of education system, something that Jamie Oliver talked like really openly about, you know, when he first came to prominence, he'd had a terrible time in school. He was heavily dyslexic. No one kind of knew what to do with him. And he turned that around when he created this academy for training young chefs and giving people a chance, you know, literally going out and saying, you don't have to be this academic person. I'd sort of I'd gone the other way in a way. And I used to feel a little bit shy about my sort of academic side. But funnily enough, as the 80s turned into the 90s, that movement became quite a thing. People sort of, we had a terrible recession going on here in the UK. And then suddenly you had this sort of doing it for the passion chefs. I should think Carla was probably one of those. I mean, she came from Italy. This was a kind of kitchen I literally stumbled in by accident, and there is this kitchen the likes of which I'd never seen before, where everything is justified by being in season. It's all about provenance. It's all about buying like really good stuff, and then this let it taste of itself, sort of thing. That's actually not the words that we used. I think it was buy the best stuff and then don't fuck with it.
Right. That's
said in the kitchen.
And that's so true, because I feel like most of the time I'm trying to fix food. Like, I've got shit.
Mm.
And like, how can I fix this? But that's such a completely different vantage point. It's like, well, don't get yourself in a position where you have shit.
Mm.
get the best food you can.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I had no understanding of Mediterranean sort of food. To show how unversed I was, and this is back when the early 90s, you know, pasta in the UK still meant spaghetti bolognese or lasagna, probably, you know, or macaroni cheese, Lord help us. And I go into this restaurant on my very first day, and I'm, you know, I'm the most junior of the junior. I'm the skivvy, commis chef. I've been given this huge pile of peppers that have been charred on the, you know, over the flame to get the skins, to rub the skins off and then make peperonata. And I remember thinking, oh, geez, I'm so much the rookie that some chef has basically screwed these peppers. He's burned the shit out of them. And I've got to spend my first morning trying to cover up the, you know, it's like to make the best of it. So I'm thinking, great. After a while, Carla comes over and she goes, when are you going to ask me what you're doing? Do you want to know what you're making? And I was like, oh, what? Sure. I was, I remember this, she was kind of scary.
Yeah.
She was quite austere looking. She'll kill me if she's listening to this. We're friends now, still to this day. I love her. but yeah, I was a little frightened of her. She was this very imposing Roman shepherd.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was really.
As you should be.
She was really uppity about being Roman as well. If you said, are you from Italy? She'd say, no, I'm a Roman. and mean it. So then I discovered this amazing thing of grilling the peppers till the skins fall off, and you know, she gets me making this and that, and it was just it was like being in kind of cooking Hogwarts.
Yeah,
I knew nothing, and so there was this just fantastic journey, and I haven't changed it. You know, I would say that just stayed with me, that those abiding principles of sort of simple treatment of things at the top of their game just doesn't, to me, it never gets old. And so I kind of, it still informs how I cook now.
When you made your own restaurant, which seems like an insane idea, to get the capital together and put yourself in £500,000 in debt, what a great idea. Did you also go Italian? Is that what you did? Or did you do something else?
I think by this time, a good, you know, more than a decade's passed, and I already had my writing career behind me. I'd come to some sort of prominence as a food writer, and luckily not prominence as a reluctant TV showmaker. And the site that we got offered was actually a really quirky little corner of the West End. It was just sandwiched between Holborn and Covent Garden, so we were just on the edge of theatreland. And on this quirky street that was pretty much like what you'd call, we don't have a sort of fair rent thing in the UK, but it was kind of fair rented.
Okay.
And because when the estate agent had said to us, are you interested in a place in Covent Garden? We'd laugh, come on. You know, I'd spent my cooking career so far working in much less salubrious parts of town. But yeah.
Salubrious, wonderful word.
And he said that was when he said no, the you know, the landlords have got this great reputation for keeping rents down. They like really interesting one-off little businesses. That's what like populates this street. So we end up in number 32 Great Queen Street. And I mean, working title in my head was sort of British Bistro, but actually, a bit like the thing I'd mentioned with the TV show, the Britishness was about the ingredients and not about that sort of jingoistic
Yorkshire pudding.
Exactly. Not anachronistic, but just buying good stuff.
Yeah.
One food critic did rumble me because he said, this is, you know, don't be fooled by all the sort of Anglo-Saxon terminology. This is an Italian restaurant in disguise. Which I was just so chuffed.
Oh.
Yeah. Because he said,
the confidence
to leave things like this, to sort of, you know, to pile up a plate with purple sprang broccoli and just dress it in oil and salt, you know, that's not a very English thing to do. That's
Britain. You know, that's Italian.
Yeah. I spot the hand of Rome. The hand of Tomasi.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Oh.
So at what point, like, in this like great journey of cooking, did you start coming to yoga? Like, when did that all integrate into your life?
As we began to get ready to open the restaurant, Two things very quickly. Having spent my years in places like the Eagle, which was, what became known as the gastropub movement. The idea is that you go into somewhere kind of shonky, just give it just enough of a lick of paint to make it look, you know, not so shonky that no one wants to eat there. But to say that Grey Cuisse should look pretty rustic is to understate it slightly. It was all the right, it was shonky in all the right ways. And I remember the builder who came to help us said, you know, there isn't a single straight line in this business. Like, he said, the whole restaurant is kind of drunk. It slowly slopes one way. But, you know, it's like old buildings in Covent Garden. Nice medieval bit of London. So, I mean, we literally gave it a lick of paint and opened it. Spookily enough, we opened it 32. It was number 32. We opened it 32 days after we got the keys.
Amazing.
Which was great. It was absolutely exciting. But I had begun to notice that. I was nervous as hell. And my anxiety was really getting the better of me. I knew that a lot was riding on this. I had only been a jobbing chef up till that point. And now suddenly I'm going to be a restaurateur. And, you know, when you just tell it, well, I had this sense that I just wasn't in the best place. And if I'm really honest, I also knew that this wasn't something new. I realized that I had to deal with something that actually bugged me since quite a young age. And that was just, I have sort of elevated levels of anxiety. Panic attacks were fair. You know, I was very familiar with panic attacks by the time I ended my teens. And like stupid boys can do, I had learned to hide these things in plain sight. I could have a full-on panic attack sitting in an exam table in school and not tell the teacher that my throat felt like it was closing out. If I just sit very still, do the exam.
With a stiff upper lip.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, you've got to start dealing with this because people are going to be depending on you. You know, you're going to have people working for you, not just with you. Sort your shit out. And someone had mentioned yoga. You know, they'd said, why don't you try? A confidant had mentioned it to me. And I remember thinking, oh, come on. No, 1,000 times no. I had this image of people that did yoga and they were not the same people that cooked in kitchens and and smoked ciggies out the back.
But they kind of are.
Of course
at that
they
point
are.
In the 90s. They're a punk artist out there hand making their life and using the material of the body to make art with it. And there was something passionate about it in that decade.
Yes, yeah.
If not at all now.
Mm. So I go to, there's a gym, like just literally a few minutes up the road where I'd been swimming for years. And I go and look on the notice board and there it is, there's yoga. On a Friday afternoon, and we're not open yet, so I sneak off from all the builders and them, and off I go, and I position myself at the very, very back of this room so that if needed, I could use the escape hatch because I just figured a 37-year-old man doing yoga for the first time was going to be like dad dancing, you know, just really unedifying.
I
need to be where no one can see and where I can get out of here.
To the back.
Yeah.
Close to the door, yeah.
And this lovely woman strode into the room. And this is the thing, without knowing one kind of yoga from the other, I'm in a sort of Ashtanga class. Mm-hmm. It's called Ashtanga yoga. And she's, you know, Surya Namaskara, if it's your first time, watch.
Did they call it, at that time, very often in England, they would call it Ashtanga. Did they do that?
Ashtanga.
No, I think she knew her. Yeah, she was.
She knew the word.
And I think probably it being at a gym, I think it was probably spelled with the H.
Okay,
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
otherwise, I would have probably called it Ashtanga, yeah.
Many of my students called it Ashtanga because they would take out the H, put the S with a dot on it, thinking that's the right way to spell it. And then every one of your students is saying Ashtanga. No, the Ashtanga is quite nice.
The Ashtanga yoga.
This gym probably had it spelled with the H, and then in brackets, yes, the Madonna one, you know?
Yes, the Madonna one.
That's what they were calling it back then. Oh, is that the Madonna
one? Yeah, at our gyms, it was always power yoga.
Power yoga,
they never call anything in Sanskrit. It was always power yoga.
And did you just watch? Did you do that?
She said, watch one sun salute, and I watched it.
Oh, right.
And then I had a weird flashback, actually. This is a little aside, but in those early travels, at one point I had found myself in Goa, and I stayed in this really beautiful beach right down in the south of Goa, almost Karnataka, actually. I think if you'd sort of walked half an hour south, you were in Karnataka. And there was hardly anywhere to stay on it. Oh, and now I think it's really popular. It's like Palalem Beach. It's like a huge deal. Back then, nothing. Two things happened that trip. One, a dog gave birth to a beautiful litter of puppies on my little A-frame hut doorstep. And two, there was this lovely couple of what I would have called old hippies back then staying next to me. I would have called them old, but they were probably younger than all
45-ish.
Every morning I would get up early and swim, and the woman of this couple would get out onto her little veranda thing and rock out. Well, I thought it must be dance or something, but I just found it very hypnotic and just beautiful. Anyway, and this being a place where there's hardly anyone else around, we inevitably end up having something to eat together one night. I say to her, Wendy, what is that thing that you do in the mornings? It's so beautiful. And she's like, oh, my sun salutes. Do you want to try them? Yeah. Do you want to try them? Come and join me tomorrow morning. So she shows me these things. And I think, oh, they're nice. And I think for the rest of the trip, I kind of tried to do them on my own. And then your spot of pattern now, I tend to be a bit like, la, 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 this is great fun. You know, I'll make these movies and not buy a VHS. So I'll do that. I just forgot. I went home, thought, that was nice. I don't think I ever heard her say yoga. I just didn't equate these beautiful sun salute things with yoga. And then suddenly, 2007, I'm standing at the back of this room and I'm like, I know this.
Right.
Yeah.
This is yoga.
That's amazing.
Maybe it had been stalking me. Maybe it's like you can run, but you can't hide. I've come for you.
First the Indian food, then the sun salutation.
You were marked by the devil.
So I started doing them, and I loved this class. It was mostly the standing stuff, you know, and it was the sequence. And she was using I didn't realize they were numbers at the time, but she was doing a lot of Ekam Dwe Tri. Fast forward, I'm going to this for a few weeks, and then suddenly the restaurant's opening. And this class is with this lovely teacher, Alex, is literally at like 5 o'clock on a Friday. And Friday dinner, I know where I'm going to be for the next.
Yeah.
I'm going to, Friday dinner, prison. So I said to her, oh, I love this. And I'm a cook, and I'm about to be in a restaurant, and I'll probably never be able to come here. And she said, well, that's okay. She said, this is kind of like a sort of sneak preview of something that isn't taught this way. She's like, I'm going to give you this guy's number. Give him a call. Go there. And it's Hamish Chandra's.
Really?
Like, yeah.
That's amazing. She was Hamish's student, obviously, teaching at the gym.
She wasn't, funnily enough. She her teacher had been John Scott.
That
all makes sense.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
It was so,
When we had Hamish on the show, I was trying to remember, they went to Crete to teach or to study with Derek
Ireland,
Was Hamish the carpenter and John was the chef, or vice versa?
No, I think Hamish went there to cook, and John was the
Hamish
carpenter.
Was a cook.
Yeah.
All right. Did you have a connection like that with him?
He mentioned that to me when I rock up there. I went in those days. You had to. I rang, and he said, "I'm very strict about it. People have to come and observe first. Just come and have a look. See if this is for you." I mean, obviously, I love the idea that there's no... I mean, AYL, Ashtanga Yoga London, he opens at 5 a.m. and it closes at 11:30. Yeah. I'm there's going to be a time when I can skedaddle up there from the restaurant. It was 10 minutes on my bike from the restaurant, on my bicycle. And also there still are evening sessions. Those were run by Roberta Giannotti.
Yeah, I remember Roberta.
So I went, looked in through the door. That was a very strange moment because what I felt was almost panic. I just remember being overwhelmed by the sight of it all.
It's intense.
Yeah, I got this really strange, quite visceral reaction to it, and I thought I was going to cry. So I was like, thanks, that's great. And I kind of bundled off back to work. And it actually took me about 3 weeks to pluck up the courage to go back.
Yeah,
it's funny.
It's overwhelming. I mean, it feels like a lot.
It was the sound of the breathing.
Yeah. Maybe some sense of like how, like, I don't know if I can do this, right? Like some...
Also something a bit even weirder than that. If this is going to sound silly, but it was almost like, you know, if you really fancy someone. No, I'm not talking about Hamish. He's a handsome chap, but it's like, I can't just kiss. I can't just have a one-night stand with this thing. If I come back in this door... it's going to be serious. I had this sense.
Yeah.
That's what I'm putting it down to these days. Maybe that's
loading amazing.
Too much onto it, but I just knew it was a big deal. And then luckily for me, I did go back in.
How did you... Okay, so this is a question I have. Like, I know when you're a chef, and especially when you own a restaurant, you're working very, very late nights.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time. How did you fit in your practice? What would you do? Would you just go straight from work to practice, or would you go home and take a nap?
I'd look for a hole in the rotor and I would go. I do remember Hamish being slightly bemused. He sort of said, you've chosen quite an interesting form of R&R considering what you're doing. But he didn't say it was crazy. You know?
Yeah.
He seemed...
Yeah.
It's one thing I've always loved about him is he's very interested in what you do. You know, right from the get-go, he always says, you know, so what's work? You know, and now I'm really familiar with, I hear him saying it to people who are new and stuff. I should say that obviously one of the reasons, in the beginning, I'm a real newbie too. I'm literally doing the standing sequence. And he was quite kind of hands-on with my standing poses. He used to say, you know, if you're a chef, and I must have told him, you know, my knees hurt, my back hurts, I'm worried because I'm heading towards 40 and I don't want to, you know, and so he's like, yeah, you just got to learn to stand up properly. You got to learn to lift those arches of those feet and use your, you know, it was like navel in, squeeze your butt, all that kind of thing. And then it begins.
Woolabanda all day long.
But the weird thing is, it starts to work. That's what I mean. At first, I must have been a bit stop-start. I would do it at home if I couldn't get. So if I had a late start, I'd get in there and then I'd see Hamish. If I was on an early, I could get there and see Ro. And they were very sweet. Normally, they used to say it's better if you can be either a morning or an evening student, so you always see the same teachers. But they were.
That's right.
They both said to me, "Just okay, we get it. Come when you can. You come." Whenever.
Yeah.
But it's funny. I remember being taken by this. When Hamish had said that to me for the first time, he'd said, now look, I'm going to be checking with Roberta that if I don't see you, she sees you. If you want this to work, you've got to come.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'll be here. And I remember thinking, God, that's kind of strict. That's quite strict, but I don't mind that. Maybe, you know, all this use in kitchens, I didn't mind the stricty bit.
Yeah.
And then it starts to work. I mean, so in the early days, I can remember just a busy, really, really busy shift is building up. And I would feel the anxiety thing, you know, the throat starting to tighten. Yeah. And the worst thing about this was I could do it, but I couldn't talk. And so then people would think, oh, he's being grumpy. And I'd be like, I'd know that I wasn't angry with anybody. I just was like, don't ask me to talk for a bit. I can just about get the orders out, but I'm actually just shitting myself, you know.
But communication is really key, isn't it? Like calling out what's needed, what needs to happen.
Yeah, and that's why I knew I needed to sort it out.
Are you expediting or were you cooking?
Cooking. Both, yeah.
You were cooking.
Running shifts and...
Oh, both.
Yeah, yeah. Running the shifts from the grill. It was a small place, you know, small crew.
Yeah.
Only three or four of us on a shift. Short menu, you know. And yeah, I can really remember. I think I'd been going to the Shala about 3 months. And one night it was just monster busy. Because by then we're getting, the critics are coming in and we are, and they like it. And so we're getting... Heavily booked.
Good reviews. Yeah, and that's great.
I can feel it coming. It's like that kind of like, and then I just remember this voice going, just breathe. Do what you do up there in the Shala. Just do that breath. So I start like, okay. And it's like, okay, right. Yeah. Inhale, move that pan there. Exhale, change that tab there. Inhale, check that he's okay. Exhale, check she's okay. And
like wow. This,
you can normally, when there'd be a storm brewing, I can hear a pin drop in my head and I'm not freaking out. I can really remember that point and I'm like, okay, this is that weird yoga stuff. It's doing something. And then I just take it and run with it. And then I'm there, I'm going every day.
That's incredible. That's so cool.
It doesn't matter how tired I am, I'll go there. And then the other thing was, it came to have a big influence on how I sort of felt about food and the practice later on. But with no control over my schedule and very little control over when I could eat or what I could eat, really, but mostly when, my digestive tract just seems to be sorting itself out. I don't know whether that's...
Your gastropub.
Yeah. Because, my pipes are... You know, I'm just feeling... And the funny lower back thing is disappearing and the ouchy knees thing is disappearing. And I'm just feeling just, good, you know.
Yeah.
Whether I wanted it to work so badly that I just knew I had to make it work or... I mean, obviously, I don't believe that, really. I think it was working.
Yeah, I mean, you're really transforming your nervous system.
Yes.
You know, moving the body with the breath, spending that time each day focused on your breath, focused on stretching your connective tissue, releasing toxins, releasing tension in the body.
Absolutely.
Essentially. And so, it totally makes sense. You know, you're toning your vagus nerve.
I think the vagus nerve has a huge...
And getting higher vagal tone.
Huge part of it. And at this point, of course, I've not read Yoga Mala or anything like that. So I don't know that Janushi Shastna and Mari Shastna are meant to be sort of squashing my colon, you know.
Yeah. And you get good digestion. And...
But when I begin to suspect that this is what's happening... I start becoming quite bookish about it. And, you know, suddenly I'm like, oh, my God, this is amazing.
Right. Now you're studying.
Yeah.
I mean, and even just like that's such a great point, even just the circulation, right? Bringing circulation into different areas of your body that aren't necessarily getting that circulation brings health and healing because that's what heals things in the body is.
Yeah. You
know, our body wants to heal itself, but it needs the right circulation and ability to absorb nutrients and things to do that.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I have to apologize because you're such a marvelous raconteur, but we're kind of right up against the time.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of things I really want to ask you about. I want to ask you about the Houses of Parliament. I want to ask you about the things you were doing with Jenny Wilkinson. Maybe need to do a part two with you.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because this is just fabulous stuff. And I could hear about cooking and Ashtanga, the Ashtanga, all night. But maybe we should just do a quick word about what you're doing now. I want to find out all about why you would have this sweet spot of a restaurant and then, you know, you really packing in. You're probably packing in Monday and Tuesday nights as well, not just Friday and Saturday nights.
Yeah.
Is a fabulous restaurant then,
right?
We
just heard Gordon Ramsay say, if you can get the customers,
punters,
get them in
punters,
on Mondays and Tuesdays, you're 90% there.
Yes.
Friday and Saturday will take care of itself.
They will. It's true.
And so why ever stop?
Oh, why did I stop?
yeah, why ever stop? Once you get it to that sweet point, and I didn't mean to interrupt your sentence, which I was like, oh, was he going to say something else about cooking in the restaurants?
No, I was thinking to say about Monday and Tuesday nights, like Friday, Saturday, you know, like a DJ set. That's the Stormers. You just make the greatest hits. On Monday and Tuesday, it's like the early set. You can be a little bit more adventurous on Monday, Tuesday than you are on Friday. Oh. So it's a great shift Monday night. If it's busy, you don't want to be in Dudsville. It's boring and exhausting.
Yeah.
Like morale would get low.
Yes. Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah.
God. So would you do like a little different menu or something?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. The menu changed pretty much daily. Yeah.
Wow.
Because it's a producer's.
Depending on like what was in season.
Supplier's menu. People used to say, how do you write the menu? I'd be like, no, the suppliers write it for me. They tell me. So, I mean, that's really just the switch. That was what would be different from the old sort of more haute cuisine kind of way. You know, the chef will sit down and write his wish list of dishes. My generation was sort of saying, tell me what to buy. And you've got these amazing greengrocers and things that you trust and small scale suppliers who are coming directly from farm gate. The kind of stuff that everyone now can buy online. But of course, that wasn't there then. The idea of sort of even, I mean, buying food online still seems quite futuristic to me.
Me too.
Yeah.
That does remind me of like seeing a video of like Nancy Silverton as the supply truck comes in.
Yeah.
And she's just like, what do you have? And she looks at it and is like, oh, okay, well, that's what I'm going to cook today.
That's exactly what we were doing. That's, supplier's menu. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Wow. That's
fabulous.
And the season.
Okay, well, let's stop. No, say what you were going to say about the season. Oh. And then we can just like transition into part two, because I want to talk about the yoga community and the...
Yeah, the season's kind of... I mean, to me, that was the biggest influence that Carla had on me. I especially living in a city like London, where you can be oblivious to that. Every supermarket, every large retailer is like a smorgasbord of the same ingredients all the time. You know, so that obviously, when Wimbledon is on, there might be some English strawberries, but then the rest of the year they come from a polytunnel in southern Spain or even further away. The idea that there was this incredible, beautiful rhythm that the year has was such a huge eye-opener to me. It's interesting that I had to encounter another cooking culture to sort of find it. But that is the story of British food in the 21st century, I think. It had a lot to do with the ease of travel onto the continent and the, well, tragic, really, the whole burgeoning of the European community. European became the European Union. The budget airlines taking you to funny little airports that didn't exist, you know, when we were younger, and suddenly you could fly to Puglia or... you know, or to Andalusia, not just the Costa del Sol, but, you know, Granada in the mountains. Anywhere. With that, you've got this huge burgeoning curiosity about other approaches to food. And that really is what wrote the menu. I mean, it's an interesting way to go about things, isn't it? It's the thing that these days I mostly talk about when I'm talking to people about food and when I'm doing workshops or whatever around it. You almost have to, first of all, see it as a restriction, but you're only restricting yourself at the point of that actual season. So if you're going into one of those huge supermarket type retailers, you've got to put the blinkers on to not look at the Peruvian asparagus, because you want to wait for the local asparagus in early summertime.
Yeah. What's the benefit of that? Like, what's the benefit of eating close to home versus, you know, having the bananas all year long?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it doesn't have to. I mean, local and seasonal have a relationship, but that's not a 100%. It doesn't have to be, you know what I mean? It's not all or nothing.
Yeah.
Because there are beautiful things that come in and out of season from all over the world. I'm thinking of, like, you know, in India, the beautiful mango season. And very luckily here in London, in the UK, we're able to buy Indian Pakistani mangoes when they're around, because we have so many Indian retailers. But of course, all year round in the supermarkets are those sort of wherever they're from. Sometimes they're from the Caribbean, sometimes they're from South America, sometimes they're from parts of Africa. Do you know what I mean? They're like these great big, almost like steroidal mangoes that taste of nothing because they've been picked on the ripe and they've been imported in a way that they can be stored on the shop shelves for as long as possible. And it's just the same thing all year round. Asparagus is probably one of the more sort of tragic stories of that. You know, in Mexico, to a certain extent, but mostly in Peru, they've found a way to fool asparagus. Asparagus is a fern. It likes cold soil and warm sun. So what it likes is the spring. It likes a lengthening day, but not too long a day. So it pretty much in Northern Europe from the middle of April to basically around the longest day, you know, the equinox, the 21st of June sort of thing. After that, it wants to bolt. You're eating the shoots of a fern, a bit like fiddleheads, you know? That's what asparagus is. Yeah. And if you let it bolt, it sends up this beautiful spray of leaves. They look almost like frondy, like fennel or something. And then in autumn, these beautiful red berries. You've got to let it do that because it's a perennial. You need to let it bolt and then die back. Otherwise, it's not going to do its thing next year. And you've got quite a short window when it's good to eat because after it's bolted, you don't want it to go there. In Peru, they found this way of fooling the asparagus into just keeping going. And you do it by doing drought and then excess water, excess water. It's to do with, it's done via water supply, cut the water supply, plenty water, which of course in turn is having a disastrous effect on the water table. And these polytunnel after polytunnel of asparagus is leaving Peru and no one locally eats it because it's just not part of the local culture. And the sole reason for that sort of sorry state of affairs is so that big retailers, maybe Walmart in the States or Tesco Sainsbury's here or whoever, can say, there you go, there's your asparagus all year round. Because, you know, you've got to be able to eat that all the time. And the trouble is, of course, if you say you're not the world's most confident shopper or cooker, and you go into the shop and you're being sold this incredible choice, but you just keep eating the same things all the time. And then the health, you know, food health sort of police are telling you, eat a varied diet. You're like, I'm trying. I'm eating five vegetables a day. You know, it's a trap. It's a trap, and it's all being caused mainly by people who are just trying to make a load of bucks out of everybody. It's not being done for benefit. It's being done to line pockets and create this illusion of choice. Whereas if each month of the year you're saying, okay, I know this is good now. I know it's in season. And yes, it could be locally grown, but it could just as easily be a treat from far away. Those mangoes, I'm going to just go mango mad in May, June, July, and then they're gone. Yeah. You know, and then of course your diet is naturally varying across the year, but it takes it takes a shift in perception. Does that make sense? Sadly, I don't know. Here, the culture here is still not about giving people the confidence to make choices in the shops and then to be able to cook for themselves. You know, there's this terrible over reliance on ultra processed sort of convenience food, again, being produced mainly to make huge companies very, very wealthy.
Yeah.
Gosh, that was fantastic. We're probably going to stop there for the end of part one. Mm. But I have to say, if you just pushed the accent a titch, you would really very much resemble Stuart Lee in your stand-up. You're right there. If you just push it a bit, you're so close.
Well, I can't wait to jump back into this because now we're talking about food politics, which I love to talk about. But we also have to talk about Ashtanga Yoga and
the Houses of Parliament.
Yes.
Similarity to the chefing world and the cooking culture. And
yeah, the main thing is that, you know, I mean, just so we stay on topic, what I noticed, you know, that same thing about, sadly, I see wellness kind of tropes playing a lot of the same nonsense on people as the commercial kind of growing stuff, you know, like all this idea of eating for health, and a lot of it sadly is processed gimmicky nonsense,
rubbish. Let's pick that up next time.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Finding Harmony podcast. I want to remind you of an incredible class that's open to you by donation. When you make a donation to Yoga Gives Back through my personal fundraising page, you will be invited to join my spiritual wellness workshop happening on June 16th. The recording will also be available. By participating, you're not only investing in your own spiritual growth, but you're also supporting an incredible charity, an incredible non-for-profit that I love. And I truly believe in Yoga Gives Back. It is dedicated to empowering women and supporting children in India through higher education and through microloans. And your donation isn't just a gesture. It is actually a lifeline for those in need. So mark your calendars, June 16th. Join me, find the link in my show notes, and come into a meaningful journey of yoga. Make your practice, your investment in yourself, fuel positive change around the world. Together, we can truly cultivate wellness, not only for ourselves, but for our whole world, especially for the women and the children, the young girls in India who need our support, who are being empowered by this money through education and microloans. Your donation is making a huge difference. I've seen it for myself and been so inspired to support and continue my support of this incredible non-for-profit organization. So reserve your spot now. Be a part of something bigger. And I just want to thank you for your generosity in advance. Come join Yoga Gives Back and join me in June supporting women, young girls, higher education, and women building businesses in India, which is incredible. I hope to see you there. That's it. We've concluded another episode of the Finding Harmony podcast. I just want to thank you so much for doing the work that changes the world, starting with yourself. It truly does make a huge difference. Please make sure you have your automatic downloads turned on wherever you listen so you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes. I have so much more magic I can't wait to share with you. Lastly, if you're on Instagram, I love connecting and hearing from you. So come on over and say hello at Finding Harmony Podcast. And you can also come say hello to me personally at Harmony Slater Official. Thank you again for being here. I cannot wait to share more with you in our next episode.